me want to do this? The carved woman turned slightly toward me. It was necessary. She's a child, Beloved objected. You used her ruthlessly.
I didn't realize, Ration said, and he sounded both guilty and unrepentant.
It didn't hurt me, I objected, but when I tried to stand up, I could not. The mother offered me a cup of the soup from the pot, and I drank it in long sips. There were warm spices in it, and some of them stung my tongue. Beloved watched me drink. Boyo was breathing, and it was a good sound. I set the cup down on the deck and said, The ship made me love her. I think it was like that thing dragons can do. I was suddenly very tired again. When they make themselves so important to someone, I read about that somewhere.
Humans call it a glamour, the ship said quietly. Your name is B. I give you thanks. At the end of this voyage, we will all go our separate ways. It grieved me that Althea and Brashen might have to go without their son. But he will live and go with them and be a comfort to them. And knowing that will be a comfort to me, I think, even as a dragon.
As B should be a comfort to me, and Purr, and her sister Nettle. Ship, interfere with this child again, and I shall—
You have no threat to offer, Amber. Be still. She has done enough for Boyo. What would I ask again of her?
He had fallen silent, but I could see words piling up in him like unrecorded dreams. I will be fine, I assured them as I stood. I had to smile. Vivacia, you are as beautiful and perfect as you told me. I could love you. I was only a little tottery and very tired. Don't tell that. I'm going to go to sleep. Good night to all of you. Behind me, the adult spoke softly. My hearing has always been keen. Brashen spoke with regret.
She must have been a very pretty child once.
Such scars, but thanks, Sar, she is here with us now. She has great heart. I beg you to be more careful of her. She is not strong. Not yet.
That was Beloved. He was wrong. I could be as strong as I needed to be. It bothered me that he tried to protect me, that he thought I was weak and tried to make others believe it as well. It made a hot little fire of anger in me. My legs trembled slightly as I made my way back to my hammock. I couldn't get into it. I thought of the first time I'd had to climb onto Priss's back, my horse. Purr was right. I'd be glad to see my horse again. When Beloved spoke, I startled.
Bee, that healing was a kind thing, but you must think first of your own health. You are not well yet. I won't ask you to promise me, but I will ask that you let me know if you're going to do something like that. Someone must be with you who has your best interests at heart.
I do not think the ship would have let me go too far, I said. I smiled inside as I felt a warm, wordless reassurance that she would have stopped me. To him, I showed an expressionless face.
You are like your father. That isn't really an answer to my request.
He smiled, sad, but serious. I sighed. I wanted to sleep, not talk. Even more, I didn't want his concern for me. It wasn't his task. I found a lie. You needn't worry. My ability to do this is almost gone. The smile changed to a worried scowl.
What do you mean?
The night I fought Simph and Dwalia and Vindalia, Simph had a vial of serpent spit. What Dwalia called serpent potion. I think it had traces of silver in it, like the silver paragon used to turn into dragons. I yawned wide. Suddenly I wanted to explain. In a dream I had, they got it from keeping a sea serpent in a very tiny pool of salt water. Simph was going to have Vindalia drink it. He had used it before, and it gave him great power. But when I set fire to Simph, she dropped the vial and it broke. When I was stabbing her, I cut my feet on the glass and some got into my blood. It made me stronger than Vindalaya. I was so strong, I could just tell Dwalia to be dead. And she was. He went still. I watched him. Would he fear me now? Hate me? No. When he came back to himself, his eyes were sorrowful.
You set fire to Simph and stabbed her.
How could he think it sad that I had done that? I put it clearly. I told you when I told my father. I killed them. It wasn't evil, and I have no regret. It needed to be done. I was the one who was in the place and time to do it, and it was my task. So I did it. I should have killed Vindalaya that night, too. It would have saved us a great deal of trouble.
Did you dream it?
He asked hesitantly. When I stared at him, he said,
Did you have a dream that killing them was something you were supposed to do?
I shrugged one shoulder. I seized the edge of the hammock, and this time I got into it. I pulled up my blanket. It was summer above, but below decks it was chill at night. I closed my eyes. I don't know. I have dreams. I know they mean something, but they are so strange I can't connect them to what I will do. I dreamed a silver man carving his heart. The serpent spit was silver. Was that a dream of me carving Dwalia's heart into death?
I don't think so, he said quietly.
That had been a recent dream. I felt better for having told someone. I'm going to sleep now, I told him. I closed my eyes and ignored him. He did not move. It was very annoying. I'd hoped he would leave. I waited a long time and then looked through my lashes. I was going to tell him to go away. Instead, I asked, Did you love my father? He went as still as a cat. When he spoke, it was with reservation.
I had a deep bond with your father, a connection I had with no one else.
Why won't you say you loved him? I opened my eyes to see his face. My father had given him all his strength, and this man would not even say he had loved him? His smile was too tight, as if he was forcing a different expression to be a smile.
It always made him uncomfortable if I used that word.
He did not use that word very much. His love was things he did.
He never counted up the things he did for me, but he always remembered the things I did for him.
So he loved you. Loved you so much he left me to take you to Buckkeep. All expression fell away from his face. His peculiar eyes were empty. He wrote long letters to you, but he had nowhere to send them. He missed you desperately. He loved my mother, but he always had to be strong for her. He had Riddle, too, and my brother Hap, but the things he wrote about in those letters were things he could not say to my mother, nor Riddle, nor Hap. You left him, and all he could do was write them down. I watched him carefully and saw my barbed words hit and hold. I wanted to drive him away. I did not care that I hurt him. He was alive, and my father was dead. I added, You should never have left him. His voice and face were expressionless as he asked,
How do you know what he wrote?
Because he did not always burn them every night. Sometimes he waited until the morning.
So you read his private papers?
I believe you read my journals? He looked startled.
I did,
he admitted. You still do. When you think I am deeply asleep, you have looked at my writing. He did not flinch.
You know that I do. B, you have endured much, but you are still a child. Your father gave you into my care. I promised to watch over you. Understand me, adults do what is best for a child. Parents especially have that obligation. It comes far before doing what you wish or what you might think is best. You have a white heritage. Your dreams are both important and dangerous. You need to be guided. Yes, I read your journal to know you better. I will read the dreams you write.
My mind had snagged on his earlier words. Do I get my white heritage from my mother? For I knew my father was mountain and buck, and nothing else.
You get it from me.
I stared at him. How?
You are young to understand this.
No, I am not. I knew my father and I knew my mother. I held my breath, waiting for him to tell a terrible lie about my mother.
Do you know how the dragons change the elderlings? How they give them scales and colors? How their children are born sometimes with scales?
No, I did not know they did that.
You saw Rapskull, the Scarlet Man?
Yes.
A dragon changed him. A dragon loves him very much. So Hebe, the Red Dragon, added something of herself to Rapskull, and he changed. And Rapskull's dragon, Hebe, has taken on much of his thoughts and ways.
I was listening intently.
For many years, I lived alongside your father. I think we both changed each other.
I saw his thoughts wander into a different trail.
He said once that he had become the prophet and I the catalyst. I thought long about his words. I decided that I wanted it to be so. For once, I wanted to make the change. So I came to Clare's castle and tried to be the changer.
You were not very good at it.
No. But when I first met your father, I would never even have thought of trying.
He gave a great sigh.
I expect you to be angry at me, Bee. I will tell you this. I did what your father wanted me to do. I got you out safely. When I intrude on your life and privacy, it is because he charged me with taking care of you. My word to him comes first. I had hoped to win your respect, if not forge a closer bond. I understand that you resent that I am alive and Fitz is not. But why unleash this tonight?
I steeled myself and looked into his pale eyes. Tonight, you tried to act like my father. You said things he might have said. But you are not my father. I don't want you to behave as if you are. You can teach me, yes. There are things I need to learn. But you are not my father. Don't pretend you are.
Actually,
he began. Then he stopped. He concealed something. He'd read my dreams and my journal, my most private thoughts, and still try to keep secrets from me? Insult most deep. I struck back. An omission was as good as a lie. He wrote you a last letter, one he did not burn, for I think he wrote it mostly for himself. He told you that he understood why you had left, that your friendship had never been anything but how you could use him. He wrote that he was better off without you, for my mother loved him for who he was rather than how he could be used. In that letter, he said he hoped never to see you again, for you had twisted his life and robbed him of joy. That he was pleased to take control of his life and determine his own direction now. But he saw you again, and it happened again. You only came back to him to use him again. You destroyed our home, and he lies dead because of you. All you. I rolled away from him. Not an easy task in a hammock. I stared up at the timbers and the shifting lantern shadows. My father would not have been pleased with me. I knew I should apologize and admit my falsehood. Even if I didn't mean it? Perhaps. I looked back at him, but he had fled.
Chapter 42. Fernic. And among the remnants of what was burnt, and there was not much, your protégé was very thorough, I found a scorched scrap. I have transcribed it here. As soon as they are unable to fight, go forward boldly and bleed them. It is essential to do this swiftly, while most of the poison is in their bellies and has not tainted meat, bone, brain, or tongue. Harvest the blood, then the organs, and last the meat. Label each tub, for each must be tested separately to see if the poison has been too strong and rendered it lethal. Administer some to at least 2 slaves. If even one dies, dispose of it. Unfortunately, we cannot control how much each dragon will eat of the bait, and therefore we cannot control how much poison each beast will consume. The eyes must be preserved in vinegar. They are the most perishable. Slice the meat thinly, salt it, and dry it. Of the entire creature, only the stomach may be summarily discarded. Every other bit must be harvested and preserved, for once we have eliminated dragons, these are the last that we... And here it ends in scorching. Old friend, you are right. Our servants deliberately slaughtered what remained of the dragons and serpents following the disaster to the north. Other bits of documents, with only dates and the number of casks and barrels, would hint to me that the slaughter was carried out in various locations. Hence the dragon's vengeance, hence also the longevity of the Four. Following the murder of Capra, I assumed the care of the few remaining whites. We have left Clares for a small farm inland. I am trying to teach the youngsters to grow and harvest food. Many have ceased dreaming. I fear this letter will take many months to reach you. When last I parted with Fitzchivalry Farseer, we exchanged some hard words. Please extend my respect to him. I do not doubt that he will return to you, just as you made your way back to him. Letter from Prilcob to Beloved. The fool had told me of how he had returned to Clares the first time. All I had to do was to make that same journey in reverse. I had to get to the other side of the island, to one of the deep water ports, Sizal or Cropton. From there, I would find a boat to give me passage to Fernic. There, on the hills around the port of Fernic, I would find the Elderling ruins and a heavily canted skill pillar. It seems so simple if one says it quickly. Most things do. I took shelter in the mouth of the tunnel for the night. It was, as Lant had told B, a defensible point. At dawn, I climbed to what seemed the highest hill and looked for a road. I cut across a pasture where 2 cows regarded me with suspicion, down the hill, past the recent ruins of a farmhouse, and struck the road. There was little traffic, but I knew that would change as the news of the fall of Clares spread. This way would come the plunderers and salvagers, and the sort of folk who would be quick to take advantage of the battered population. Rumours of dragons would not deter them for long. I hoped that Prilcop would swiftly seize the leadership position I had left vacant for him. The surviving whites, and whatever servants followed them might, under his tutelage, go back to the old ways. In any case, I was done with them. My leg was still healing and ached. I was constantly hungry. Mosquitoes feasted on me, and something like a tick had bitten the back of my neck. I could find no little body, but it itched abominably. I missed my shoes badly. That afternoon, a small shadow overflew me. On the next pass, Motley dropped onto my shoulder.
"Take me home," she directed me.
"Did you miss the boat?" I asked. I wouldn't admit that I welcomed her companionship.
"Yes,"
she conceded after a time.
"Crow, Motley, how did you know I was alive? How did you know where to find me?"
"Silver man, but still stupid,"
the crow observed. She lifted from my shoulder, but called back to me,
"Fruit tree! Fruit tree!"
She flew ahead of me down the road. Within me, the wolf was both amused and annoyed.
"In my absence, you bond with a crow? Well, at least she is not prey, and she is clever."
"We are not bonded."
"No? Well, you are not bonded as you and I were, that is true.
but there are many levels of wit bond. She senses you, even if she does not care to let you borrow her senses. Suddenly, many things became clear to me. I felt offended. Why does she keep me at a distance? I wondered. She knows you will never cede to her the sort of bond we shared, and so she protects herself. When I made no reply, he added, I like her. Were I still trotting at your side, I might welcome her. I smelled the ripe fruit before I saw the tree. A small orchard, a narrow road led to another collapsed dwelling. The dragons had been thorough. Unharvested apricots had fallen and were fermenting on the ant-covered ground. The heady smell and the buzzing of bees and wasps filled the air. Ample fruit still hung on the tree, and I was not slow to fill my hands and then my belly. The juice inside them eased my thirst as well as my hunger. When I could eat no more, I picked a generous amount and fashioned what remained of my shirt tail into a sack. I returned to the road and hiked on, hoping that I would hear a wagon's creaking or a horse's hoofbeats in time to conceal myself. My stomach was cramping from all the fresh fruit, but it was less painful than hunger. From time to time, Motley flew a lazy circle over my head. Very cautiously, I extended my wit toward her. Yes, if I focused, I could sense her. But I also felt a small indignant push of repel. I let her be. The fool had never told me how many days the journey had taken. I did recall that he had spoken of traveling at least part of the way in a cart. I had only my feet. I slept in the open each night and hiked on each day. Food was what I could find, and many of the plants here were foreign to me. The few greens I recognized as edible were not filling. The days were too hot, and the nights full of stinging insects. That evening, I tried to find a comfortable spot to sleep where the gnats would not devour me. It wasn't possible. I sat with my back against a tree, slapping mosquitoes, and reached out to Dutiful. I could let him know I was alive and making my way home. I wanted Bee and the Fool to know that as soon as was possible. Perhaps Dutiful could arrange funds for me. The skill pillar could take me as far as Kelsingrar, and I hoped I'd be welcomed there. But coin in pocket is always useful. Disaster had stripped me down to the silver-holed clothes on my back, the knife in my belt, and the few small assassin's tools left in my little pockets. I centered myself and pushed away my awareness of gnats and a rock poking me, and reached for Dutiful, only to fail, as I had not failed with the skill in many a year. I swatted the little bloodsuckers from the back of my neck, pulled my shirt up over my head, and tried to think. I tried again, and again. It was like trying to scoop a tiny fly from bubbling soup, always to miss. I stopped and pushed my frustration aside. Calm. What was wrong with me? I hadn't had so much difficulty in years. Not since I'd been trying to skill to Berity, trying to reach him when he was in the mountains. Berity, who had also soaked his hands in silver. Perhaps the difficulty had not been entirely mine. Perhaps there had been more at work than my elf-bark habit. I touched my silvered fingers to my thumb and focused on the peculiar power coursing through me. Pain, no. Pleasure, no. It was too intense to classify. I focused on Buckkeep, on Dutiful, and for a moment I was in the skill current. I plunged into a depth that I'd never known existed. I was buffeted and shoved by the mobbed and streaming awarenesses.
Forgot to feed! He's so lovely!
My boy! Not enough coin!
It was like being in the great hall at Buckkeep. If all the musicians were playing, and all the people were talking at once in equally loud voices, I could not sort one from another. Then an immense presence, powerful and disciplined, would cut through the prattle like a commander's order being barked above the discord of a battle, or a great fish swimming through a dense school of minnows. All would part, and then close up behind it. Once, long ago, I'd encountered one of those great beings in the skill current. I'd nearly lost myself in her. In this strata, There were many of them, and as they passed, I felt other entities attached to them, combining to grow that awareness. I wanted to... I dragged myself clear of it, and came to myself, biting my lower lip so hard I tasted blood. I tried to puzzle out what might be happening to me. The silver had increased the power of my skill, taking me to a level that I could not master. I put up my walls and pondered that. Caution, I decided. If need be, I could wait until I reached Kelsingra and then contact Dutiful by messenger bird. There was no sense in taking risks. As I came to each crossroads or byway, I chose the more travelled path. I had to veer widely to avoid villages. I found I was glad that the dragons had not completely slaughtered the inhabitants of the island. Nonetheless, I had no desire to encounter anyone in my silvered condition. Sometimes the crow helped me find a way, and other times she was absent, and I had to blunder through woods and down trails and hope for the best. I stole shamelessly from outlying farms, raiding vegetable gardens and hen coops and smokehouses. I took a sheet from a laundry line. There were a few coins left in the corner of my pocket, and I tied them in a shirt sleeve on the line. Even assassins have a bit of honor. Hens would lay more eggs and vegetables replenish, but taking a sheet was a true theft. I knotted the sheet into a makeshift cloak and gained some shelter from both the baking sun and the biting insects, and I walked on. The weather continued fine, and the journey was miserable. I wondered and worried about Bee and the Fool and my other companions. I mourned Lant. I wished vainly that I had seen Paragon transform into dragons. I wondered how long it would take them to get home. I worried what would happen when they delivered the news of the prince's demise to Queen Etta. She had charged us to keep the lad safe, and we hadn't done so. Would there be grief, or would there be anger, or both? Hunger was a given. Thirst came and went, depending on streams. And I ached. My weariness was constant. My body continued to heal and stole my strength to do so. My diet was uneven. I had no shoes. I was hiking and sleeping outdoors, as I had not done in years. But even so, my level of lethargy was extreme. I woke one morning with no ambition to move. I wanted to go home, but more I wanted to be still. I lay on the bare earth in the shade of a tree with drooping leaves. Ants began crawling over my hand. I sat up, slapping them away, and then scratched the back of my neck. The tick bite was slow to heal. I picked the scab away from it and felt some relief.
"Hom!" Motley squawked at me from a branch overhead. "Hom! Hom! Hom!"
"Yes," I conceded, and gathered my legs under me. They ached, and my belly hurt. "My brother, you have worms." I considered that thought. I'd had worms before. What man who has lived by his wits has not? I knew several cures, none of which were available to me right now.
"You made me swallow a copper coin when I was a cub."
"A copper bit kills the worms, but not the pup. I learned it from Burrick."
"Heart of the Pack knew many things."
"I haven't a copper left to my name. It must wait until we are home, to where I have access to herbs I know."
"Then you'd best get up and get moving toward home."
Night Eyes was right. I needed to get home. I imagined embracing Bee with my silver hands and gleaming face. Oh, no. I pushed that last thought aside. I was becoming adept at doing so. When I was home, it would all come right. I'd see Nettle and my new grandchild. There would be a way to deal with the silver. Shade would know something, some way. No. Shade was dead, and so was his son. What sort of a welcome would Shun give me for that news? Had the elderly woman been right? Was the silver killing me? It would sink down to my bones, she had said.
"Get up. You are lying there while the sun moves, unless you have decided to sleep through the day and travel by night."
The moon would be full tonight. I'd be able to see. Yes,
I will travel tonight. I was lying to myself. At nightfall, I forced myself to rise. The crow had perched above me. I looked up into the darkened branches, and to my surprise, I could see her. I saw the shape of her body by its warmth. The fool had spoken of this when he drank the dragon's blood. I'm going to travel. Do you wish me to carry you? Crows did not fly in the dark. She gave a dismissive caw. She could find me when it suited her. She had shown me that. The road had become well-traveled over the last few days, but there were fewer carts and horses on it by night, and my sheet cloaked most of me. I made good time. Stones, heated all day by the sun's warmth, gave off a different sort of light than the small mammals that foraged along the edge of the road. Another climb up another hill. The road cut through tilled lands and pastures. Where would I hide this day? Worry about it when dawn came. I topped the hill and looked down onto a bustling seaport. Lanterns burned bright on the ships anchored in the harbor. Lamps gleamed randomly throughout the sprawling town. It was at least as big as Buckkeep Town, but spread out as flat as batter in a pan. How was I to make my way through that, get to the docks, and persuade a boat to take me to Fernick, and all without a copper to my name? Steal a small boat, and go where? I had no charts. I needed a boat and a crew that would obey my will. Why was nothing ever simple? Why was I so weary? That night, I raided a chicken coop and took a hen as well as 3 eggs. I helped myself to grain from the cattle's shelter and stared down a watchdog who came to snarl at me. I told him he faced a wolf and felt the silver stitched together with my wit to send him yelping back to his doorstep. It felt peculiar. I fled with my loot. Man's teeth do not do well on raw meat, but I persevered and stripped the hen down to her bones. I followed with raw eggs, gulped down and grain ground between my cow's teeth, and all washed down with stream water. On a rocky berm between 2 grain fields, I settled for the day. I waited for night. Before the moon rose full and white, I skulked toward the busy port. Thick had used the skill to hide himself, but he had always been far stronger in it than I was. I arranged my sheet to cover most of my face, and I kept to the shadows even as I sent out, "Don't see me, don't see me," to any I passed in the quiet streets. There were few folk on the street at night. Only 2 gave me even a glance. The strength of influence I was now able to exert with my mingled magics was unsettling and reassuring. How much dared I trust it? Could I walk the busy streets in daylight and be unnoticed? To test that and fail might be deadly. I knew my destination, and I did not pause. I headed down to the docks. A harbor never sleeps. Ships unload or take on cargo by night to catch the morning's tide. I chose a dock where an ant stream of longshoremen pushed carts and barrows to docked ships. I stayed to the shadowed areas as I studied the moving cargo. I was hungry again, aching and weary. I could not allow that to deter me. I found a ship offloading hides. The fool had spoken of Fernick being a tannery town. I stepped in front of one of the sailors. "I need passage to Fernick." I enveloped him in my friendliness. "You really want to please me," I whispered. He halted, glaring at me as I peered from under my sheet. His face went slack. Then he suddenly smiled, as if I were an old friend. "We have just come from there," he told me. He shook his head. "It is not a pleasant place. If you must go there, I pity you." "And yet, I must go there. Of the ships in port, are any bound there?"
"The Dancer, the 2nd one, there. Her captain is Razri, good for most things, but a terrible cheat at games of chance."
"I will keep that in mind. Good evening to you." As we parted, he gave me a loose-lipped smile, as if I were his lover. I felt queasy for what I had done to him as I hastened down the dock to the Dancer. She was a tidy little vessel with a deep hull and small house, one that could be sailed with a very small crew. A young woman was standing on the deck. I sharpened my will
then reached toward her with a wave of good fellowship and trustworthiness as I asked for Captain Razri. Her eyes widened, and she smiled at me, despite my drapery.
"I'm Captain Razri. What business have you with me?"
She saw my silvered face and took a step back. I smiled at her and offered that it was a peculiar scar, no more than that. She politely looked away from it. "I need passage to Fernic."
"We take no passengers, good man."
"But for me, you could make an exception." She stared at me, and I felt her struggle. I pressed harder on her boundaries.
"I could," she admitted, even as she shook her head, "no.
I can be a handy person to have aboard. I know my way around a deck."
"You could be a help,"
she agreed, as her brow furrowed. "How many days is it to Fernic?"
"No more than a dozen, if the weather holds fine. We've two ports to visit on our way."
I wanted to tell her that we would go straight to Fernic, but could not bring myself to do so. Already I regretted what I was doing to her. "When do we leave?"
"On the early tide. Soon."
I was no sooner on board than Motley swooped down and perched on my shoulder. The puzzlement on the captain's face gave way to delight.
"Thank you, thank you,"
Motley told her, and did the same when the crew approached. I introduced myself as Tom Badgerlock, while the crew was charmed and distracted by Motley, and I settled acceptance over them like a blanket. By morning, I was on my way. It was the most miserable voyage of my life. The ship was called Dancer for a reason. She bowed and bobbed, rocked and wallowed. I was seasick as I had never been before. Yet despite how wretched I felt, I did my best to be as useful as I had presented myself. I found that I could remove corrosion from brass by smoothing it with my fingers, and made every fitting on Dancer gleam. I smoothed fraying lines so that they ran easily through the blocks and tackles. I ran my hands over stretched and weary canvas to tighten it. I ate no more than one man's share at the table, despite my constant hunger. The journey seemed interminable. Imposing my will on the crew took strength and focus when my supply of both was dwindling. I dreaded each port stop, for it meant days tied up as they took on and offloaded freight. Each time we made port, I would slip away at night to skill a plentiful meal at an inn. Sated, I would return to Dancer and sleep heavily. When I woke, I would feel stronger for a day, but then the lassitude would return. In the long, heaving nights, I thought of Verity and how he had used his skill to defend the six duchies. Even at a distance, he had been able to find the out-islander ships and influence their captains and navigators. How many had he sent into the teeth of a storm or onto the rocks? How had he felt to use the power of his magic to kill so many? Had it bothered him? Was that why he had seized on the wisp of an old legend and gone off into the mountains in search of elderling allies? The night we reached Fernic, I conveyed to the captain and crew that they had done a great kindness, something to be proud of. I left them looking puzzled but rather pleased with themselves. Motley settled on my shoulder.
"Home,"
she reminded me, and I took strength from that word. Fernic was a dreary town of bad smells and sour folk. Turning cattle into meat and leather is a messy business, but it did not need to be as squalid as Fernic made it. The town was dirty, and the air tasted of hopelessness. It crouched in low, ill-kept buildings all around the bay. On the hill above it, I could see the tumbled ruins of what had been an elderling city. It had obviously been deliberately destroyed. I hoped that no more destruction had been done to the skill pillar than the last time Prilcop and the Fool had used it. The Fool had described it as nearly toppled, but if there was any room to wriggle under it, I would take my opportunity and hope that it would take me back to Kelsingra.
"There is a danger in using the stones. Wolf, there is a danger in delaying my return, and I fear that is greater." I felt his doubt and tried not to be prey to it. As I plodded through the town, I was hungry, but saw no tavern where I wanted to eat. They seemed deceitful and untrustworthy places. I would go straight to the elderling city,
Find the skill stone and leave this disgusting place. The aura of ugliness was like a stench in the air. In Kelsingrar, they would know me. There would be food and kindness there. This place had never known kindness. I stopped to breathe and leaned against the wall of a stable. My feeling of despair was like a wind that swept through me. The intensity of it was oddly familiar, as was the buzzing in my ears.
Here they betrayed us. For years they deceived us and pretended to be our friends, and then, when need was upon us and we fled here, they slaughtered us. They ended us as they ended the dragons and even the serpents in the sea.
For a moment, I saw them. The elderlings ran through the streets, seeking a safety that did not exist. They had fled the collapse of their cities and come here, to an outlying settlement where the air was not poisonous and laden with ash. But as they emerged from the portal stones, hired soldiers were waiting to kill them. For the servants had known that their cities would shake and fall, had known that both dragons and elderlings would flee here. To end the dragons, they must end the elderlings as well. And they had. The memories of that bloody betrayal had sunk into the memory stone of their city. When later generations had salvaged the stone of the elderling city to build Fernic, they had salvaged the horror and betrayal as well. Small wonder that the folk of Fernic regarded the black stone ruins with hatred. The closer I came to the ruined villas on the hillside, the deeper and darker the memories flowed. Skill and silver writhed in me, and I staggered through a flow of ghosts. Men and women shouted and screamed. Children lay dead or bleeding in the streets. I threw up my walls to deaden the horror. Kelsingrar was a fountain of elderling memories of festivals and markets and joyous times. Here, the stones had drunk up the blood and the deaths of the elderlings who had raised them. That terrible legacy of fear and despair had been passed down for generations. Any merry or peaceful memories had been quenched in blood. I did not know the name of this elderling town. Grass was trying to grow between the broken paving stones, but too much memory stone had been used. The streets recalled that they had been streets and did not allow the grass to flourish. Everywhere I saw the signs of hammers and chisels, toppled statues deliberately broken to pieces, fountains destroyed, building walls pulled down. Where would the standing pillars have been? In the center of the town as they were in Kelsingrar? Atop a tower? Within a market square? I wandered the empty streets of the hilly town, wending my way through a tide of screaming ghosts. Motley would lift from my shoulder, circle, and then return to me. Once, this had been a beautiful place of opulent manors and walled gardens. Now, it was like a fallen buck infested with maggots, all its majesty and graciousness tainted with memories of death and hate and betrayal. Only my wit assured me that they were not real. My wit made me aware that there were real people too, not far from me and following me. In my efforts to keep my walls tight and my mind my own, I had neglected my camouflage of skill. Perhaps they were just curious adolescents following a peculiar stranger wearing a sheet. Had they seen my silver, spattered face? Motley cawed overhead. I watched her circle, and she suddenly dipped down to light on my shoulder.
"Careful," she croaked in a hoarse whisper. "Careful, Fitz."
They were closing in on me. I stood still, breathing quietly. I flung my wit wide, trying to sense how many and where they were. What did they imagine I had that they would want? Were they simply the sort of ruffians that enjoyed giving a stranger a beating? I had no strength left to run, let alone fight.
"Leave me alone."
I flung the plea out into the night, but the skill-infused stones diluted and muted me. I needed to see them, to look into their faces, to target their minds. They kept their distance. Doubtless they knew the ruins well. Perhaps they had braved this miasma of fear and hate since they were children. they kept to cover. I would catch a glimpse in the growing dusk of someone flitting from one concealment to another. How many? Four? No, five. Two were standing close together. I flared my nostrils and took in scent, an almost useless gesture with my feeble human nose.
They are near. Choose your place.
That was my last advantage. I drew my knife as I found a bit of standing wall to put my back against. I discarded my sheet cloak. Perhaps my appearance would give them second thoughts, but in the gathering darkness, would they even see how peculiar I had become? With a sinking heart, I forced myself to question what sort of people would willingly drench themselves in this atmosphere of hatred and blood. It was not a good sort. I heard a low laugh, and someone shushing someone else. It had been a woman's laugh. So, this was sport rather than robbery. I was probably not their first prey. A rock hit the wall beside me. I flinched, and the crow lifted from my shoulder. I didn't blame her. A single strike would kill her. Another rock struck near my head. I stood still, listening. The next rock struck my thigh, and this time their laughter was not hushed. They remained in hiding, unseen. I heard the soft whistle of a sling, and that rock struck hard on my chest. I lifted an arm to cover my face, but a rock struck me in the mouth with a sharp crack. I tasted blood, and my ears rang.
Cowards!
Night Eyes snarled inside me.
Kill them all!
When Night Eyes had been alive, our wit bond had been so close that I often felt I was as much wolf as human. His body had died, but something of him had lived on inside me all those years. Part of me and not part of me. And from my earliest time of trying to master the skill magic, my beast magic, my wit, had been tangled with it. Galen had sought to beat it out of me, and others who had tried to instruct me in the wit or the skill had decried that I could not seem to separate the two. When Night Eyes, infuriated by my pain, struck out with the wit, my silver skill rode with it. I had a glimpse of the woman moving from a broken wall to a thicket of brambles. I fixed my attention on her.
Die,
I said quietly, and she was the first to fall. She dropped suddenly and limply, as if stunned, but my wit told me she was gone. Heart stilled, breath stopped. Foolishly or loyally, perhaps both, two of her male companions ran to her. After all, why not break cover? A cowering cornered man was no threat. I lifted a shaking silver hand. I pointed at one.
Die,
I told him, and as his fellow stood in consternation, die, I suggested, and he did.
So easy. Too easy.
He did it,
someone shouted.
I don't know how, but he's dropping him. Saha, Ba, get up. Are you hurt?
One of them ventured from cover, a scrawny youth with dark, ragged hair. His eyes were on me as he sidled toward the bodies.
They're dead, I said.
I hoped he would run. I hoped even more he would fight. A woman, cautious as a doe, rose and stepped from the tall grass. She was lovely, her loose, dark hair curling to her shoulders.
Saha?
She said, and all laughter had fled from her uncertain voice.
He killed them!
Her companion cried, his voice rising to a shriek. He charged at me, and she screamed as she copied him. I moved my silvered hand across their path. They dropped just as surely as if my axe had lopped off their heads. They fell, and my wit immediately told me they were gone. Never had I used my magic in such a way. Never had it been strong enough. This was like when I had first tried to learn to skill, and my ability had been wildly erratic. In fear and anger, I had thrown death at people I had not even clearly seen.
I did not know we could do that.
Within me, Night Eyes seemed cowed by what had happened.
Nor did I.
Had I felt shamed by bending the minds of the dancer's crew? Now I felt numbed with shock, the same calmness I'd seen in a man with a leg lopped off. I spat the blood from my mouth and touched my teeth. Two were loosened. My enemies were dead, and I was alive. I pushed remorse away. I looted the bodies. One of the youths had sandals that would fit me. The pretty woman had a cloak. I took their coins, a wineskin, a knife. One woman had a little paper pouch full of gummy, mint-flavored sweets. I gobbled those down and followed them with the cheap wine. I looked aside as Motley took bits of flesh from them. How was it different from my looting? They were dead, and she took what was useful to her. Night thickened, and the moon rose. The memory of mayhem in the now ruined streets rose in volume. Motley huddled on my shoulder. Were the folk who had slaughtered the elderlings the ancestors of those who now lived in the pathetic town below? Was this lingering horror and hatred a terrible unplanned punishment that fell on children who had no knowledge of what their forebears had done? Did the dark humors of this place taint the younger generations of those killers? I found the skill pillars by following the phantom carnage backward. I waded through ephemeral corpses and shrieking specters until I came to a place where the ghostly elderlings milled like sheep surrounded by wolves. They had emerged from the skill pillar, seen the slaughter, and tried to flee back to dubious safety. At the vortex of that maddened flight, I found the pillar. It was as the fool had said. Someone had put a great deal of effort into trying to pull it down. It leaned low, and the full moon above glinted on its scratched upper side. The outer faces of the pillar had been scored with scratches, and there was a strong stench of urine and feces. After all the years, there was still a hatred so strong that it was expressed in this puerile way. Humans piss when they are scared. Tall grass surrounded the fallen monument. Ghostly elderlings were emerging from it, clutching children or carrying an armful of belongings. I dropped to my knees and pushed my way through coarse grass and tangling bindweed. I wished I'd had the map Shade had given me, of all the known pillars and their destinations. No matter. Gone was gone, and I hoped the bear had enjoyed eating it. The fool had said they had emerged from the downward-facing plane of the skill pillar. All I had to do was go back the way he had come. I peered through the vegetation into the black space under the leaning stone. Motley clung to my cloak and shirt collar, leaving scratches on my neck.
Are you ready?
I am never ready for this. Just do it.
Home. Home now. Very well.
I pushed brambles aside, wincing as the thorns tore my palm. I'd have to crawl to get under the pillar. A moment of the stupidity that weariness brings was all it took. I braced my hand, my silver hand, on the face of the pillar nearest me, preparatory to crawling under it. It seized me, and I had a glimpse of a spoiled rune I did not recognize. Motley gave a terrified caw, and we were pulled into the stone.
Chapter 43, Bingtown.
To Skillmistress Nettle, from Apprentice Carol. As you demanded, I confess my fault on this paper, and offer also my explanation. It is not an excuse, but it is a reason why I disobeyed the journeyman Schurz, who was supervising me on our visit to Aslivyal. I was aware of our assignment. We were to gather skill cubes, note where they had been found, and bring them back to Buckkeep Castle for reading, classification, and storage. Schurz was most clear in telling me I must stay with the others and touch nothing that did not pertain to our task. Yet I had heard tales of the map room of Aslivyal. My desire to see it outweighed my sense of duty to obey. While unobserved, I left my coterie and sought the map room and discovered it was as wondrous as the accounts had said. I lingered longer than I intended, and instead of returning to where we had been gathering the cubes, I went directly to the pillar that had transported us there. This is the most important part of my tale, even if it does not excuse my disobedience at all. The others were not yet at the pillar. I was weary, for my bag of gathered cubes was heavy. I sat down with my back to the wall. I do not know if I dozed or was simply taken by the memories in the room. I began to see elderlings coming and going from the pillar. Some were grandly dressed, and some walked through as simply as if strolling through a garden. But after a time, it struck me that elderlings either emerged from or entered a facet of the pillar. There was no face where elderlings both entered and exited. I believe that we should carefully study the runes on each pillar face, for I believe that some of the issues of time lost or great weakness may be the result of us using the skill pillars to travel backward, counter to their intended use. When it came time to return to the witness stones, I felt great trepidation. I attribute our day's delay to entering a facet of the pillar that I saw elderling shadows only emerge from. For my behavior in leaving my coterie, I apologize. It was thoughtless and reckless. I submit myself for judgment and punishment as you see fit. With great sincerity, Apprentice Carol. We sailed on. Slowly, I woke to life. Dwalia had left her mark on me. If the weather was cold and wet, my left cheekbone ached, and sometimes yellow tears ran from my left eye. My left ear was a shapeless lump. I could not sleep with it touching the pillow. The bruises and abrasions from the neck shackle had left sores that were slow to heal. But that was my body. The rest of me simply didn't want to do anything. I wanted to stay in my hammock in the dimness. I wanted Beloved and Amber and the Fool to all stop pestering me. Every time I wrote in my journal, I reminded him of that. Despite the reminders, several times a day he would seek me out. If I were in my hammock, Amber would sit nearby and busy herself with a bit of needlework. Sometimes she left clever little carvings of animals, and these, I guessed, were the Fool's work, for my father had written of such things. I longed to possess them, but I always left them where Amber had placed them. Mostly, I avoided looking at her, but whenever our eyes met, his peculiar ones were full of remorse and pleading. He was never less than patient with me. I had a little fire of dislike for him, and every chance I got, I fed it. I thought often of how he was here, and my father was not. I imagined what my father and I would have done on this journey home. We would have talked with the ship and watched the seabirds. He would have told me the history and geography of the six duchies and explained Bingtown and the rain wilds to me. My father would have been steady and fair with me, but he was not here. Every time I looked at the changeable man who was trying to replace him, I disliked him more. Purr was more direct. He insisted I come to the table for meals, and while I ate, he showed me knots. Boyo was up and tottering around. He joined us at table once, and I was so embarrassed by his gratitude that I could not look at him. His mother always smiled at me. Captain Wintrow gave me a necklace with a gem that glowed in darkness, and a mug that magically warmed whatever was in it.
"You need to know this ship, while you have the chance," Purr rebuked me one afternoon. "When will you ever sail on a live ship again?" "Never. They will all turn into dragons. Be here while you can."
I knew he was right, but trying to do anything made me so tired. One day he insisted on showing me how to climb the rigging.
"Please be, only 5 steps up, just so you feel how the ropes are under your feet. All you have to do is follow me. Put your feet where I put my feet, and your hands where I put my hands."
He wouldn't let me refuse. He didn't ask me if I'd be afraid, and, just as it had been with Pris, I could not break my pride enough to tell him it terrified me. And so we climbed, and climbed. Many more than 5 steps. There was a tiny room at the top of the mast, with short walls of webbing. He helped me inside, and I was glad to hunker down and feel safer.
"This is the crow's nest," he told me.
His face became sad for a moment.
"Not that I have a crow anymore."
"I know you miss him."
"Her, Motley. She never came back after she followed the red dragon that day. Maybe she lives with the dragons. She was very taken with Hebe."
He was quiet.
"I hope she is alive. The other crows used to peck her because she had a few white feathers. Would it be worse with shiny red feathers?"
"I'm sorry she's gone. I'd have liked to know a crow." He said suddenly,
B, you healed Boyo's burns. Why don't you fix yourself?
I turned my face away from him. It stung that it mattered to him that he noticed the scars on my face and wrists. I knew he had no magic, but he still seemed to hear me.
It's not about how you look, B. It's about pain. I see you limp. I see you putting your hand over your cheek when it's hurting you. Why don't you just make them better?
It doesn't feel right, I answered him after a time. I could not say that I didn't want to have to do it myself. My father should have been with me to smooth my face with his hands and admit to me how badly I'd been hurt. Why did I have to mend myself? Because Amber was here instead of my father, but I could not say any of that. So I found other words. My father wore his scars. Riddle has scars. My mother wore the marks of all the children she had borne. My father even said they marked my victories. To just make these go away, I touched my crushed cheek. I could feel how the bone was pushed in. It wouldn't undo what they did to me, Per. He tilted his head at me. Then he opened his shirt. I stared in astonishment as he unfastened the collar laces and laid bare his hairless chest to me.
"See where I took an arrow for you?"
he asked me. I stared. His skin was smooth over his muscles.
"No."
"That's because your father erased it. He healed me, and Lance too. And you should have seen what the fool looked like before your father worked on him. Fitz even took the fool's wounds and put them on himself so the fool could heal faster."
I was silent, wondering how he had done that. It did not increase my respect for the fool that he had given my father his scars to bear. Per touched my cheek. I realized I had been silent a long time.
"I can see that this hurts you. You should fix it. You can't make it unhappen, but you don't have to carry around what they did to you. Don't give them that power over you."
"I will think about it," I told him. "And now I want to go down. I don't like how we are waving about up here."
"You would get used to it. And after a time, you might even like coming up here."
"I will think about it," I promised him again. And I did. 2 days later, at a time when the winds had died and our sails hung limp, we climbed the rigging again. I wasn't sure that I enjoyed it, but I could convince myself I was not that scared. For several days we were becalmed, and slowly I made the crow's nest a familiar place. Often it was already occupied by a sailor named Ant. She didn't talk much, but she loved the rigging. I liked her. Bit by bit, in the night, in my hammock, I repaired myself. It was not easy. I did it slowly because I didn't want anyone to notice it. I didn't want them to say I looked better, or to praise me for doing it. I could not explain the why of that, not even to myself. But my ear, the crumpled ear my father had touched and called a victory, I left that as it was. I came to love the ship. I think it was because I could feel how Vivacia felt about me. If I put my hand on the silvery wood of her railings, I could feel her. It was like my mother looking up from her sewing and smiling at me when I came into the room, a small welcome and a good wish for me. I was not bold enough to speak to her very much, but she was full of kindness toward me. That was the only conversation I needed with her. I heard her have other conversations with her captain. It had taken me some time, but I had sorted out that Captain Wintrow was Althea Vestrit's nephew, and that Vivacia was the ship of the Vestrit family, and that Althea had grown up aboard her. Live ships, it seemed, were very important to the families that owned them. That Paragon had turned into two dragons and flown away meant that Althea and Brashen and Boyo no longer had a ship, and Vivacia wanted to do the same. Then there would be no live ships for any of them. Per was right. Before I was a woman grown, all the live ships would be gone. That saddened them, but there was a more immediate conflict. I had been sitting in a coil of rope near the foredeck and had dozed off there. I woke to a group of our sailors standing in a respectful row, their hats in hands. I had not heard what they asked of the ship, but her reply made it clear. Vivacia refused to put into the pirate isles. Her captain pleaded with her. Boyo importuned her, but she was adamant. I could see that her black curling hair had the grain of wood, but somehow it still moved when she shook her head.
Kennetson will never be less dead, no matter when or how they receive the news. We all know how terrible it will be for Queen Etta and Sorkor, and indeed all the Pirate Isles. Do you think I did not care for Kennetson? He was not blood of my blood, but I cared for him. I knew his father, and perhaps understood him far more than I enjoyed. I respect some of what he did. Nonetheless, I have no wish to be trapped in Divitown while Etta rages and curses and weeps. And you know she will have 1,000 questions, followed by 1,000 accusations and rebukes. She will delay me for weeks, if not months.
So what do you intend? Navigator asked the question.
I intend to bypass the Pirate Isles. I know you need supplies. I am not the mad ship, to care nothing for my crew's lives. I can compromise. We can stop briefly in Bingtown. Then I will go up the Rain Wild River to Treehog, for silver, to become the dragon I was always meant to be.
What of me? Captain Wintrow asked discouragedly as he came to join the discussion. What will Etta think of me? Do you think I will ever be able to return to Divitown if I do not bring Queen Etta the news of her son's death? He shook his head. It will be the end of my career there, perhaps even my life. Althea and Brashen and Boyo were coming to join them. Did they fear a mutiny on the ship? Vivacia was silent for a time. Then she said with both firmness and regret,
I know only that I have been too long a ship. Wintrow, I am trapped. I need to be free. I will free myself, as you should free yourself. It has been years. Etta will never love you as she loved Kennet. She is a woman whose love was won by coldness and neglect. She thought a man who did not beat her loved her. And Kennet? He never admitted to himself that he cared for her as anything more than a convenient whore. He was fonder of you than he ever was of me. Wintrow, go home. Take me home. It is time we both were free.
So long a silence followed the ship's words that I wondered if they had all left. I opened my eyes to slits and saw Althea set her arm across her nephew's shoulders. The crew stood embarrassed for him, looking aside from his downcast face.
She's right. Boyo whispered the words. You know she's right.
But at that confirmation, Wintrow shrugged away from Althea's touch and strode away from both family and figurehead. I judged it better to continue to feign sleep and never speak to anyone of what I had overheard. Most of Vivacia's crew were from the Pirate Isles. The ship's refusal to put into port there left those sailors bereft and resentful. I felt the tension simmer and was puzzled. The crew knew it was not Wintrow's decision, but the ship's, so what did they expect him to do? But when we were within sight of the Pirate Isles, Captain Wintrow offered his compromise. He gave our ship's boats to those who wished to leave Vivacia's deck and go to Divitown. Only one boat he would keep back, despite knowing it would not hold us all should some disaster befall Vivacia. Yet, given the opportunity, it was only 12 or so who chose to depart. Some who had long sailed with Vivacia decided to stay with her, to see her become the dragon.
That will be a tale to tell for years, and a sight I will not miss, declared one man.
And at that, two who had sought to leave decided to stay. Wintrow bade farewell to the others and assured them that the ship's accountant would see them paid. And Boyo said to the oldest man,
I trust this to you, to give to Queen Etta. All of you leaving the ship here, this must not go astray.
But what he gave them was only a rather plain necklace with a dull grey charm on it. I did not understand why the crewman was so stricken with gravity. They promised him many times it would go directly to her. The boats were lowered, and we watched them row away across the waves, and we left the Pirate Isles behind us. That night, Captain Wintrow got very drunk, and Althea and Brashen with him. Boyo stood the night watch and commanded the ship. Clef kept him company, and Purr. They sat on the foredeck near the figurehead and sang some rude songs. The next day they all went about their work with blotched faces and shaking hands. Amber and Spark helped to fill the gaps left by the departing sailors, and the ship seemed almost to sail herself in her drive to reach the rain-wild river. I had another episode of the sickness in which I became weak and feverish. When Amber sought to reassure me that all would be well, I said that I'd been through it before and wished to be left alone. Amber seemed to find that astonishing, but acceded to my wishes. It was Purr who brought me water and soup, and when the fever had passed, begged permission of the captain that I be allowed to take a bath in his quarters. I was given a tub to stand in, a cloth to use, and a bucket of hot water. I had longed for a tub full of steaming water, but Purr explained that given Vivacia's refusal to stop in the pirate isles, we had to conserve our fresh water. With what they gave me, I could rid myself of most of my peeling skin. I emerged a colour that was a shade closer to Purr's skin, and feeling much better. It was peculiar that the very boredom of our uneventful voyage became difficult for me. After months of plotting each day how I would survive, there was suddenly very little for me to do. No one expected chores of me. Over and over I was told to rest. In those idle hours, I was left to recall every detail of what had befallen me. I tried to make sense out of all that had happened. My father was dead. The people who had stolen me were dead, or mostly so. I was going home, to Buckkeep Castle, to a sister I did not know well, and a niece who was a baby. I thought of the things that had been done to me, and the things I had done to survive. Some I could scarcely believe. Biting Dwalia's face, watching Trader Acriel die, becoming the destroyer, and killing Dwalia, and setting fire to Simph and burning all the libraries. Had that truly been me? B. Farcia? I had dreams, both those full of portents and the ordinary kind. Sometimes it was hard to tell the difference. I wandered the walls of Withywoods, calling for my father, but only a wolf came to me. Trader Acriel crawled after me, screaming that it was all my fault. I tried to run from her, but my legs were jelly. A blue buck leapt into a silver lake, and a black wolf leapt out of it. A dozen dragons rose in glorious flight. Dwalia stood over my bed and laughed to think I had believed I could kill her. I dreamed of a woman who ploughed an immense field, and golden grasses grew up to be harvested into creaking wagons. I dreamed of my mother saying, "He may not seem to love you, but he does." I dreamed I watched a grand ball in an immense, festive chamber through a crack in the wall. Some I wrote down on the paper Beloved had given me, and some I kept to myself. He came to me one evening and said,
"I propose that we sit down together, and you read your dreams to me, and we discuss them."
I did not want to share them. Writing them down made them important. Reading them aloud would make them even more so. I said nothing. He sat down beside me on the foredeck. It had become my favorite place to be in the evening. His long hands, one gloved, one bared, were folded loosely in his lap.
"Be, please, let me know you. There is nothing more important to me than that. I want to know you and to teach you the things you must understand about yourself. Teach you about your dreams and what they might mean and what life may demand of you. Some day, you must find a catalyst and begin to make the changes."
I noticed that he did not say he wished me to know him. Amber, fool, beloved, that he was. I covered my drawing of Trader Acriel. I made a smile for him. I found a catalyst, and I made my changes. I'm finished with that. I thought of what my father would want me to do. I drew a great breath and tried not to hurt his feelings. "I don't want to be a white prophet like you were."
"I could wish that we could change that, but I'm afraid that for you, it's inevitable. Let's set that aside. Would you tell me about your catalyst?"
He tipped his head at me and asked gently,
"Is it Purr?"
I tried to hide my dismay for such an idea. Purr was my friend. I already told you, my catalyst was Dwalia. She enabled me to be who I had to become the destroyer. She changed my life. She took me from Withywoods to Clares. There I made the changes they all feared I would make, and then I killed her. I am the destroyer, and I destroyed the servants. He was silent for a time. His fingers, some gloved and some bared, toyed with one another.
Are you sure that Dwalia was your catalyst?
Prilcop said she was. I corrected myself. Prilcop said he thought she was.
Prilcop has been known to be wrong.
He sighed suddenly.
B, I thought this was going to be so much easier for both of us. But then, I had hoped your father might be with us, to help us become friends, to help you trust me.
But he's dead.
I know.
He suddenly sat up straight. He tilted his head to consider my face. Those eyes. I looked away. He spoke to me anyway.
B, do you blame me for his death?
No, I blame him. I hadn't known I was going to say that, but now that I had, I felt a surge of righteousness. It had been his own fault that he died, and it was fair that I was so angry with him. Beloved took my hand and his gloved one. He wasn't looking at me anymore. He stared off over the sea.
I do too, and I think I am as furious with him as you are.
I tugged my hand away, as if he were innocent. We sailed up the shifting coastline they called the Cursed Shores. Day by day we drew closer to Bingtown, until the night we could see its lights in the distance. Beloved set out plans for us. We would disembark in Bingtown, send a messenger bird to Buckkeep Castle that we needed funds for passage home, and wait to hear back from them. Althea had invited us to stay in her family home until our funds arrived and our passage was arranged, and Amber had gratefully accepted. Until our funds arrived from Buckkeep, we were paupers, dependent on her charity. The day was sunny as we sailed into Trader Bay and then Bingtown Harbour. Vivacia went directly to the docks reserved for the live ships. Our arrival caused a stir, and soon the other live ships were calling to her. It was strange to hear ships shouting to one another, demanding news. Apparently, the two small dragons that once had been Paragon had stopped in Bingtown to exhort the other ships to follow them to Kelsengrah. Now they wanted to know, was it true? Had these dragons once been Paragon, the live ship? One live ship, named Kendry, was the most vocal, roaring that it was past time for ships to be free dragons. His figurehead was a handsome, bare-chested young man. He was tied at a separate dock from the other live ships, and his masts were naked of canvas. Most of the ships were curious, but Kendry's anger was frightening. It was not only the ships that were in uproar. No sooner were we tied up than a contingent of folk in peculiar robes came down the docks in a gaggle. As I disembarked behind Beloved with Spark and Purr, they were demanding permission to board. "Who are they?" I demanded as we passed them by. Men and women alike were garbed in robes of differing colours and wore grim expressions.
"They are members of the Bingtown Traders' Council,"
Beloved as Amber spoke quietly beside me.
"Each of the original families who settled here has a vote in the Bingtown Council to make decisions that bind all. The prospect of the live ships becoming dragons will upset many of them. The live ships and their ability to move up and down the Rainwild River, as well as their swiftness upon the open seas, have long given the traders a distinct advantage. Their vanishing will affect not only the families fortunate enough to have owned them for generations and to have founded their fortunes upon them, but all who have relied on them to bring first to Bingtown the finest goods from the Rain Wilds."
"Boyo told me the council won't be happy about any of it," Purr said, summing it up. "They'll likely have a big meeting tonight to decide what's to be done."
Bingtown was a place of beauty and bustle in equal measure. Folk walked with purpose in their stride. A woman loudly hailed a man, demanding to know where her shipment of fine calf leather was. Two men rose from a table and leaned forward to shake hands over a pot of tea and two cups. A messenger dashed past, her pouch of missives clutched to a bouncing bosom. Clares had been a town of passive pastels and calm folk. Bingtown roared with colour and commerce. The scents of spices and rich meats floated on the air. Amber grinned as she strode through it and seemed familiar with the town. She was not certain of every turning,
but soon found a place where we could send a messenger bird to Buckkeep Castle. Spark produced a small pouch and counted out careful coins from it to pay. As we left, Spark hefted the little bag.
Not much left of our funds, Amber.
We are fortunate to have any. Whatever we have, it must suffice, she said. She was attired somewhere between a man's and a woman's garb. We were all in borrowed bits of clothing, for we had come aboard the Vivacia with only the clothes in which we had gone overboard. In comparison with the smartly clothed traders and the colourfully garbed folk on the streets, we looked like beggars. We were on our way back to the ship when Spark shrieked and bolted away from us. I looked up to see a man charging toward her. He seized Spark around the waist and hugged her tight, then spun her around. I was groping for my belt knife when Purr shouted, "Lant! How can it be? Lant!" And it was. He was baked brown from the sun and more ragged than any of us. But it was Lant, indeed. His restoration was enough to decree that we would spend what little coin we had to share a small meal. We sat at a table outside a tea-house under a canopy. Lant supplemented our coins with his. I was clinging to wreckage when the Sea Rose passed me, fleeing the harbour. Her crew threw me a line, and I clung to it until they drew me aboard. I begged them to take me back, but neither mate nor crew would hear of that. I'd landed in the middle of a mutiny, for they'd left their insane captain behind them in Clarice. It was a fine tale as he told it. He had worked aboard her as a common